So the question I've probably been most commonly asked is, you know, when is the lab report due? And it's due now, but maybe a different question to ask is, when am I going to start grading them? Because I don't really care if I get them up until the moment I start grading them. And I'm probably not going to start grading them until Wednesday noon. So if you can get to it to me by Wednesday noon, I don't care.
Are you flashing through the chest?
I'm recording. Yeah, so if you look at the website, you can listen to last time's bubble chamber lecture. Yeah. It hasn't turned out to be used, not by you, but by my astronomy class as much, but a little bit. And it's painless. Questions? Okay, so we got these dead physicists that we're talking about. What did they do? Which ones of them have you heard before? Heard of before? Boltzmann, yeah. I think he's probably the most famous of these guys. What did Boltzmann do? That's not a lot of people who have a whole constant named after him. So he's got the Boltzmann constant named after him. KB, or I think in our book mostly just K. And what the Boltzmann constant does is, when multiplied by the temperature, it gives you the so-called thermal energy. So that's certainly one important thing Boltzmann did. I can think of lots of other ones. Can you?
Does Richardson have a law?
All of them have laws. So we're going to be studying all of these laws. Child's law, the Stefan-Boltzmann law, Richardson's law, Kirkman's law. No, that's... what else did Boltzmann do? I think we talked about this before, but maybe not. Maxwell Boltzmann. Right, that's not like a hyphenated name. That's Maxwell and Boltzmann. They dealt with this distribution of speeds of the atoms in a gas. Other things for Boltzmann. So all of these things have to do with statistical mechanics. So it's kind of not too surprising you haven't heard about it, because that's kind of the senior level course. And putting these things together, it turns out that the so-called Boltzmann factor plays a role in lots of things. And approximately speaking, what the Boltzmann factor is the probability of finding a system with an energy E given that the temperature is T. So if the energies you're talking about are on the same level as the thermal energy, it's not an unlikely possibility. But if you're asking for an energy that's 10 times the thermal energy or 100 times the thermal energy, it's possible, but not exactly likely. So this Boltzmann factor is I think it's probably the most important bit of physics that you probably haven't run into or haven't spent a lot of time cogitating yet.
The whole thing, or just the KUT?
So the probability of finding a system with energy E is E, that's the 2.7 E, to the power minus E divided by KT. In a system at that temperature. So to give you kind of a particular example, you all remember the hydrogen atom, right? So this is the high school version of the hydrogen atom, which is good enough for us, right? So there's a sequence of orbits, and the energies of these orbits depend on the principal quantum number, minus 13.6 electron volts divided by n squared. So usually you're going to find the hydrogen atom with the electron in the ground state. But if the temperature is high enough, it's not unlikely to find it in the first excited state. And that probability is going to be e to the minus the difference in energy between these two states divided by kt.
That's the probability of what?
That's the probability of finding a hydrogen atom not in the ground state, but in the n equals 2 state. Or 3, 4, whatever delta e is. And kt is about a 40th of an electron volt at room temperature. And I mean, if we just use this fact, right, this energy difference is going to be 13.6 times 1 minus a quarter, so 3 quarters of 13.6, roughly speaking, 10 eV. So this is going to be e to the minus, what, 400? Not a real likely thing to have happen. Now at the sun, where the temperature is 20 times surface temperature, then that number is going to go down a little bit, but it's still going to be pretty unlikely to find hydrogen in an excited state. But obviously if we go to high enough temperatures, it becomes noticeably probable to find the electron in the excited state. So the Boltzmann factor, roughly speaking, gives you the probability of finding a system with some energy given the temperature that it's at. So these other guys are unknowns to you. Well, this combination occurred in the photometry lab. So the photometry lab dealt with the temperature of stars, and stars are just objects. Now they're gaseous objects as opposed to solids, but they work the same way that these light bulbs work. At different temperatures, they have different power outputs. Right? So this knob changes the temperature of those filaments. If this knob is way over, it's very bright. And if this knob is way over here, then it's pretty dim. So there's a real strong dependence of the light that's produced depends on how much surface area there is and on the temperature to the fourth. So if you double the temperature, you're going to get 16 times as much light. And there's a universal constant that's usually called the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, or sigma, that gives us that relationship. Let's step back for a second in the context of the photometry lab and talk about what else we see when you turn this knob. Right, so what is the difference between that light and this light, aside from brightness?
Color.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a color shift. And that's exactly what we're going to be doing in photometry. We're going to be finding the temperature of stars by looking at their color. Red stars aren't as hot as white stars, which aren't as hot as blue-white stars. And that's because the thing that's like the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution that gives you the energy distribution of the light that's produced, looks, if we plot wavelength versus amount of light, for a cold star, we have lots of long wavelength and not much light totally. If we have a hotter star, then we have shorter wavelengths like blue, and we have more light at every wavelength. And this all falls under the category of black body radiation. And Planck is the famous dead physicist who's associated with it. And you studied all of this in 320, I'm pretty sure. Okay, so Stefan is actually the senior author. Boltzmann was his student, and this is exactly the law that they proposed, that for a hot object, The light that's produced depends on the temperature to the fourth. So, of course, in order to measure that law, we're going to need to measure the temperature, and we're going to need to measure the power output and see if they follow that relationship. And, you know, the temperatures we're talking about are temperatures of close to the melting point of tungsten, right? So they're not things we can measure with a normal thermometer. So how are we going to measure the temperature and the power out? Well, the device we're going to be using consists of a vacuum chamber, and then we have some leads that penetrate the vacuum chamber, and we have a tungsten filament that is suspended inside this vacuum chamber. It's a lot like these light bulbs, except actually there isn't vacuum inside of those light bulbs. I think there's argon gas inside of them. And by measuring the resistance of this wire, we can get a handle on what the temperature is. It turns out that for metals, approximately speaking, the resistance is proportional to the temperature, and the exact calibration standards are listed in the book. The other thing that's true, and it turns out this work goes back to GE when they were building light bulbs, is the current that goes into that wire turns out also to determine the temperature with a particular calibration curve. So just as usual, we're going to have two different ways of measuring the temperature, and they're not going to give us the same answer, and it's going to be evidence of systematic error. Right? The only way we really detect systematic error is by having two numbers that disagree, and that's certainly going to be the case here. How about the power out? Well, the power out has to be the electrical power in. Right, because this thing is sitting in a vacuum, so the power that we're putting in has to come out someplace, and the only way it can come out is in the form of light. So if we measure the voltage across and the current going in, we can calculate the power, and we can look for this relationship between the temperature to the fourth and the power output. Okay. So that's one of the experiments we're going to be running with this, with the device. The other experiment we're going to think about is evaporation. So let's first of all think big. So why doesn't the Earth's atmosphere evaporate? Why doesn't it escape into space? No, I don't think so. The atmosphere is actually pretty hot upstairs. It gets cold for a while up to Mount Everest, but eventually it gets quite hot.
Gravity.
So that's certainly, I think, the first answer. The same reason this rock stays on the planet, right? It's because I'm not able to throw it at 25,000 miles an hour, right? If I could throw it at 25,000 miles an hour, it would escape. But the atoms are moving a lot faster than anybody can throw this rock. Right? The atoms are in this room are typically moving supersonically, which is like 1,000 miles an hour, so it's still well short of 25,000 miles an hour. But this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, you know, has a long tail. Some fraction of the molecules are going 25,000 miles an hour. And, you know, 4 billion years is a long time to wait. So the answer is the atmosphere is slowly escaping, right, at a rate that we could calculate by doing this sort of process. So let's think about kind of more standard evaporation. Like if I put some water on this table, you know it would, you know, over weeks evaporate. What exactly is going on there? How does that work? What controls it? You know if it's hotter, it's going to evaporate faster. So how exactly does that work? Quietly, huh? But it works very similar to the Earth's atmosphere, right? So if I have a puddle of water, you know that these atoms inside this water aren't at rest. They're bouncing around. And they're moving at pretty high speed because they have thermal energy. And if they have enough energy, they can pop out of the water. Water likes to be together, so it does take, just as there's an escape energy from the planet, there's a certain amount of energy that it takes to escape. The higher the temperature, the larger the fraction of the atoms that have that required energy, and the faster those things are going to escape. Okay, so let's take this one step further. Let's take a look at a little bit of this wire. So it's the same story, right? There are electrons that are bouncing around inside that wire. The higher the temperature, the faster they're going to be moving. If the temperature is high enough, those electrons are going to escape. And the energy it takes to escape from a metal is famous enough that you studied it a year ago, right? It's the work function. So you didn't study it statistically like this. You studied it by shining light onto a piece of wire. And if the frequency of the light was high enough, then the energy of the photon provided enough energy for the electrons to escape. Right, work function. So it's the same story, except now we're providing the energy to escape not by shining photons, but by the usual thermal processes. Okay, now here's kind of the switcheroo. So we call this thing the Boltzmann factor, but Richardson is going to be the guy who uses it, and he's actually going to get a Nobel Prize. Boltzmann hanged himself before he got a chance to win a Nobel Prize. It's an interesting story, I guess. He was depressed, obviously. He was depressed because it didn't look like atoms were going to turn out to be true. And as you know, atoms did turn out to be true. Okay, so what we should expect is that the current of escaping electrons should be proportional to the energy it takes to get an electron to leave the metal and kT. So we want to measure the current of evaporating electrons from this hot tungsten filament. And I don't know if you remember the work functions that were involved, but you know, these things are circa 1 EV as opposed to 10 EV. So we don't have to reach super high temperatures before we can start to see noticeable amounts of electron evaporation. It's not going to go very much at room temperature, right, where we're going to have e to the minus 40. But as we increase the temperature substantially over room temperature, we'll start to get a noticeable amount of electron evaporation. So the plan is to collect the escaping electrons by surrounding the filament with a can. And we're going to put a big positive voltage on this can so that any electron that escapes is going to be attracted to that can, and another lead is going to puncture this this envelope, and we can measure the current of escaping electrons. Does that make sense? So we can apply various temperatures to the filament by controlling the power that goes in these leads, and we can measure the rate of evaporating electrons by collecting all of them, by putting a large positive voltage there, and then measuring the current. You know, so let's say this is at plus 120 volts or something like that, and then measuring the current that that's going on. Okay. Now there is a kind of a technical difference between water that's evaporating from the from a puddle and from electrons evaporating inside this this piece of tungsten, and it has to do with the word degenerate. Yeah, I don't know if you talked about this in 320 or not. I see no's. Well, it's kind of a technical difference, and it is only going to make a slight modification in the resulting rule for what the current is. But let me at least define the difference between a degenerate gas and a non-degenerate gas. So again, back in 320, you work the problems of particle in a box, and we're in a box, and there are lots of particles in here. So there's a ground state, an excited state, there are all these states. What's the occupancy of those states? Well, if you think about it, the ground state is moving extremely slow, right? It has the minimum possible speed. And it's very unlikely that any atom has the minimum possible speed. So if we were to look at a graph of the energy levels for a particle in a box, they would mostly be empty at the bottom end. The ground state is not occupied, most likely, for the atoms in this room. They're all at highly excited states. So that's what a non-degenerate gas is. What a degenerate gas is more like what we think about an atom as being like. So like for the hydrogen atom, well, for a more complicated atom where there are lots of electrons, we think of the electrons being filled up until some point and then empty beyond that. So a degenerate gas is a gas that has so little energy that basically there's a dividing line between the 100% occupied state and the 100% empty states. And that energy at which the transition occurs is called, again, we have to name these for dead physicists, the Fermi energy.
You said it's when it's at its lowest energy, it's degenerate? I mean, I know what degenerate gas is, but I'm thinking of the case when all the electron shells are filled. Wouldn't that be at complete max, not minimum? What was the last thing you said right before this?
Well, so I could give this system more energy by taking the electron and putting it to an excited state. The lowest amount of energy is to pack everything into the lowest available state. So yeah, when we think about the ground state of a complicated atom, we usually think that the electrons are filling from the bottom up and that there aren't any holes in the absences in the interior core states.
So I guess I was just thinking about when all the states are full, and if it was a degenerate gas, it wouldn't really be at the lowest possible.
Well, so I think you're thinking about adding more electrons, and I'm thinking about keeping the electrons constant. I don't like to add more electrons for a variety of reasons. So if I do it naively, they're an infinite number of states, so I can't fill them up, right? Because for hydrogen atom, we have principal quantum number n that goes from 1 to infinity. But practically speaking, if you added electrons to a hydrogen atom, it would get more and more negatively charged. And so you wouldn't bind another electron to it. Right? Why would the 100th electron join the other 99? Would it be strongly repelled as opposed to attracted? Okay, so degenerate gases, we have we're close to the minimum possible state. The states are fully occupied, essentially fully occupied below the Fermi energy and essentially empty above the Fermi energy. Whereas in a non-degenerate system, the states, particularly the low energy states, have very low probability of being occupied. And it turns out that the electrons in a metal are in a degenerate state, and the atoms that are in a puddle of water sitting in this room are in a normal state. And so there are technical differences between the rate of evaporation of the electrons and the rate of evaporation of the water. But those things are dealt with in the write-up.
So degenerate just means that all the lowest states are filled, not
yes.
That you can't provide more energy to the electrons?
Correct, right. Yeah, so if I add some energy, I can knock this electron up to this higher energy state. But I can't, once I'm in an absolutely degenerate state, there's no way I can remove energy from it without changing the number of electrons. Okay, so you're thinking from astronomy where there's this connection between degenerate and explosions. No, nope.
Degenerate just means all our waves double their full.
Yep, so I mean that the electrons in the metal are not exploding and are degenerate.
Great.
Yeah, so the fact that stars explode when they are degenerate has to do with the peculiarities of the virial theorem. And remember, that's made of gravity. Gravity is the thing that's holding it together. And that plays a real important role. More questions?
You also said the electrons in the metal were degenerate.
Yes.
Or not.
Yep. So the electrons in the metal are closely degenerate. The atoms in this room are typically non-degenerate. And that just makes a technical difference between the exact formula that relates the current to the Boltzmann factor. And it turns out that Richardson himself did not get that factor correct. But he got the Nobel Prize anyway. Of all the people on this list, he might be the least deserving of fame. He didn't invent this effect. Edison was actually the first guy who noticed the Richardson effect. And there's a long history that would connect this thing to Edison. I'm hard put to say anything positive about Richardson, actually. But I haven't studied him extensively. He was a Brit. He's not an American. Okay, so here's our envelope again. Here's our hot filament. And we've got leads that go through the base to power it. And we've got this can that surrounds it. And we've got that one too. And we're planning on measuring the voltage between these two leads and the current that's flowing in and the current that's flowing out. So who's child, and what's he got to do with this all? Well, what I've said is that if we put this voltage, to a real big positive voltage, we'll collect 100% of the electrons that are evaporated. Well, what happens if we don't? What happens if we put this at some substantially lower voltage? What's going to be the relationship between the current that flows and that voltage? So Ohm's law says that there's a linear relationship between current and voltage. That can't be the case, right? Because at high enough voltages, we know it's got to end up being this constant value that's given by Richardson's law. So if we make a plot of the current of evaporated electrons that is collected by the can versus the voltage, it's going to plateau at that Richardson's value. And of course, it's got to go through zero, right? 0 volts have to produce zero current. So the question is, you know, how exactly is this going to go between these two points? And that's what Child worked out. So Child's law is the relationship between voltage and current for these evaporating electrons. It's not according to Ohm's law. Let's pause for a second and confuse things by giving everything several new names. And there's no cure for this. So I've called this the filament. This is also called the cathode. This thing I usually called the can. This thing is also called the anode. And the can really is just a cylinder that is surrounding the wire. So how are we going to work out the relationship between the current and the voltage? Well, the actual experiment is done in the cylindrical geometry, and the details are worked out in the lab manual in cylindrical geometry. But on the board, let's at least sketch out the easier case to deal with, and that's planar geometry. So imagine that I have a wall here, a metal wall. So this is playing the role of the filament. And someplace over here, some distance, let me call it B away, I have the collecting can, the anode. And this thing is at some voltage V compared to this guy, which I'll call it 0 volts. And we have electrons that are emitted from this wall, and they're going to be accelerated towards the anode because there's an electric force. And so the electric field points this way. Electrons have a negative charge. We know that the force is in general Q times E, so we have minus the elementary charge times the electric field being the positive going force for these electrons. So these are electrons are emitted at basically zero velocity, but as they move towards the can, they're going to be accelerated by that force. Now, I think you're used to thinking about parallel plates like this as the electric field being a constant between those plates. But that's not going to be the case because the electrons are going to form a cloud, an atmosphere as it will, that's going to fill that space. So even though I called that a vacuum, they're really going to be electrons in there. So we're going to call this the space charge. And if you think about it, the electrons have to be densest nearer the wall, and they have to kind of thin out as we approach the anode. So since there is charge in there, it's going to affect the electric field and vice versa. So how are we going to work this problem? Well, starting is always a good start. So what's your favorite law from mechanics? F equals ma is good. We like Newton, but we can do better.
Work energy theorem?
Say again?
Work energy theorem?
Yeah, conservation of energy, the work energy theorem. That's what that does for us is it solves us one differential equation, right? Instead of having a second order differential equation, we've got a first order differential equation. And much as we like to solve differential equations, the less we have to do it, the happier we are. So we have the kinetic energy of these electrons. So this electron is at some spot x. So the velocity depends on x. So it has some kinetic energy. It has some potential energy, which is q times v. But remember, the charge is negative. So it is going downhill. So at any point x, that's its total energy. And if you think about it, it has to start at total energy zero because it's emitted with zero velocity at 0 volts. So if I want to, I could rearrange this equation and get what the speed is, right? The speed is going to be the square root of 2e over m times the voltage. So when the voltage is zero, the speed is zero, and as we approach the anode, the speed is a lot faster, pretty much what we would expect. But what's happening to the charge density? Because the charge between those plates is going to affect the voltage. And we need to get that into the equation. Well, what's handy about conservation of energy is that it's a conservation law. It says that something is a constant. And there's another conservation law that you're used to from 200, and those are Kirchhoff's laws. Right? So one of Kirchhoff's laws is the current is a constant. So if I were to make any old plane between these two, the same amount of current would have to go through that plane because it goes through the first plane and then the second plane and the third plane. We're in some sort of equilibrium situation. Now I have to be a little bit careful here because these were infinite planes, so there are infinite currents. So I really should be talking about the current per unit area. Do you remember what that's called? Not sigma. So sigma was the charge per unit area, right?
Yeah.
So we're looking for current per unit area. Does J ring a bell? I don't know, maybe not. And of course, if we have lots of electrons going fast, there's going to be a lot of current density. So the current density, and of course, confusingly, the current is going this way, right? Because the electrons are going the other way. Apparently, we owe that one to I can't think of his name. Okay, so we have the charge on an electron, the number of electrons per unit volume, and the speed of the electrons. That's going to give us the current density. And that should be a constant. There are x's in there, but the x's have to cancel out so that when the speed is going up, the density of the electrons has to be going down, right? So that's why I said that the fluid is, the electron space charge is denser here than it is there. Well, you know, I seem to be going in circles, right? So I had two V's before, voltages and velocities, and I got another equation, but I added another variable, right? This number density. So presumably if I have enough equations, but if I keep adding a variable every time I add an equation, I'm not going to get anywhere. So I have to somehow kind of close the loop. I need an equation that's not going to give me more variables. And when in doubt, look for a famous dead physicist, right? So my math teacher famously said, the more you know about Gauss, the more you just want to have a big smile on your face. So Gauss did lots of important things. Of course, he lived before Nobel Prizes, so he didn't get any Nobel Prizes. Died happily. So what did Gauss have to say about stuff?
The flux, wasn't
it? Yeah, what sort of flux? Yeah, area, flux, I like all those things. What else?
Is he go like the surface integral? Or?
Yeah, I like surface integral. Surface integrals of what?
The shape, like it was a sphere, would be 2 pi r dr.
Well, I don't know if it would be or not, but surface integral of what? And Gaussian surfaces and all of that sort of stuff. But what do we care about? What quantity do we care about on, say, the surface of our imaginary surface?
Charge.
Say again? So I heard two things that were right. So I heard electric field and I heard charge. So what Gauss said is that if we add up the electric field dotted into the surface area, we get the charge divided by epsilon naught. What's epsilon naught? Yeah, something like that. It's a universal constant, right? We could look it up the same place we would look up capital G.
What is that supposed to be, surface integral or is that an integral?
That's a surface integral.
And then dx?
The surface area, okay. Right? So. At 200 level, often you were just multiplying areas by electric fields, but now you're learning to actually do these surface integrals, right? What this really means is that you break up your surface up into little bits, and for every little bit, you take the electric field, dot it into the little bit of area, and you add all of that up. But for nice problems in 200, like the electric field would usually be a constant or something, so you could pull it out, and then you just had the area. So. You might have 4 pi r squared for the area of a sphere times the electric field. Well, okay, yeah, that's another law. But I added Q and E. So that's not exactly looking good yet. Well. So here's my space charge, and this is going to be my Gaussian surface, these two parallel planes that are somewhere in between. Right, so this one is at x, and this one is at x plus delta x, and the electric field is going to be, something like that. Actually, it's going to be easier to derive this doing it in kind of a normal order. I think it'll just make more sense to you if this is x and this is x plus delta x, and to have the electric field like that. It doesn't really matter, but at least to me it looks a little bit more normal. So, I mean, this was planar geometry, so the electric field is the same every place along there. So the surface integral for this piece is just going to be the electric field at x plus delta x times whatever big area I want to multiply it by. And you might remember outward normal sort of thing. Right? So the outward normal for this surface is that way. So the surface integral here is going to be minus the electric field at x times the area. And what I'm going to get is the charge that's enclosed. And that I can calculate by taking the charge density times the area times the thickness that I'm talking about. All this times minus E. Okay, so let's write it down. So we have E of x plus delta x times the area minus E of x times the area. That has to be the enclosed charge, which is minus E nx, the area times delta x, all divided by epsilon naught. And you can kind of see it coming, right? There's a derivative in there. So if I cancel out the areas and bring the delta x down, got that. And so in the limit as delta x goes to 0, this is the derivative of the electric field. Incidentally, if we were going to do this in more coordinates, it turns out that what we would have is the derivative of x with respect to x plus the derivative of the electric field in the y direction with respect to y plus the derivative of the electric field in the z direction with respect to z would be the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And this thing is called the divergence of E. And if you haven't covered that yet in vector calculus, you soon will. You had a question, James.
Yes. Why is that negative EXA? Is that just trying to say EX plus delta X minus EX?
Are you saying why is this the right reason? Oh, this. So you remember that you had to use the outward normal for the surface? So when you were dealing with a sphere, the ends all pointed outward. You have to use the outward normal for the volume that you're considering. And so the volume we're considering is this volume, so outward is that way. Well, we're about to close the loop, right? Because the electric field isn't new. The electric field is given to us by the derivative of the potential, right? Just like forces are given by minus the derivative of the potential energy with respect to x. So this is the second derivative of the potential. Okay, so they're getting to be enough kind of miscellaneous constants in the derivation that it's probably useful to not bother to get it exactly right. But let's spend a second doing this. So we have the current that's equal to minus E times the number of particles per unit volume times the velocity. And the velocity is given by 2m over E times the voltage. And now we learn that the number density we can calculate by taking the second derivative of the voltage and kind of rearranging all of that. So let me include do I want to include the minus sign? No, why not? So that quantity there I can calculate by taking epsilon naught times the second derivative of the voltage. So what we've got then, after a whole lot of work, is that the second derivative of the voltage is equal to JA divided by epsilon naught, the square root of 2E over M times the voltage. Well, you guys took differential equations more recently than I did. How do I solve that one?
Separation of variables.
So separation of variables is essentially only good for first order differential equations. So this is a second order nonlinear differential equation. Wow, yeah, integration factor. So let me remind you that this equation, if we transform it, will look maybe a little bit more normal. So instead of calling this voltage, let me call it position. Instead of calling this position, let me call this time. Because then what I have is the acceleration. And I then have a function. I then have a function of x on this side. 1 over the square root is the function. So this is really just f equals ma. And in order to solve f equals ma, the plan was to introduce an integrating factor and get conservation of energy. Right? So what you did is you multiplied this by the velocity. And then you realize that this is the derivative of 1/2 the velocity squared right, the 2 comes down, and when you take the derivative of the derivative, you get the acceleration. And then you could go to town on calculating this. Okay, so the details are all in the book, and I guess I'm not sure I see a good reason to go through them. The upshot is that the current is proportional to the voltage to the 1.5 power. And that's what Child's Law is. And it's not substantially different in cylindrical geometry, although it's more work to solve. It's not that much more work to do than the planar case. And while I'm at it, I might as well name another dead physicist. So this equation, which is the same as this one, the Laplacian of the voltage is minus the charge density divided by epsilon naught. That's Poisson. We're piling them high in the back. Okay, so let's kind of review what we expect. Say again?
What is the p value there?
So that's a rho, so that's charge density. So what we said is if we measure the current of evaporating electrons from the can as a function of the voltage between the can and the filament, that's going to plateau eventually when we reach the situation where we're collecting every evaporated electron. And what we've said is that now, between that plateau and the 0, 0 point, there the current isn't going to be linearly proportional to the voltage. It's going to be proportional to voltage to the 3/2 power. Yeah. If we increase the temperature, then we're going to have many more evaporated electrons. And so we're going to have something that looks like that. Increase the temperature even higher, we're going to get something like that. So the current of evaporated electrons that's involved in Richardson's law, that has to do with the location of those plateaus. The approach to those plateaus, that has to do with Child's law. And the fact that this whole tube is producing light, is shining, that has to do with the Stefan Boltzmann law. Okay, so the plan is to collect several of these curves. Okay, and of course what I mean to collect a curve is we want to measure the current and voltage for, I don't know, 100 data points or something as we increase the voltage up to some maximum value, I don't know, 120 volts or something like that. And we want to do that maybe 20 times. So we want several thousand data points. So that may sound a little bit scary, right? Because you can't literally write down several thousand data points. So we have to somehow or other have a computer, appropriately command a computer to do a lot of this work for us. So how do we do that piece of the puzzle? Okay, so here's our experimental apparatus. We've got our filament, we've got the can, so we got those three leads that are leading from this experimental device and we're supposed to do something with. And what we need to do is to measure the voltage and the current that are powering the filament. And this filament is typically going to take amp sort of power. It's not going to happen for free. And we need to measure the voltage and current as a function of the can. So if we change the power supply, we're getting different curves because we're changing the temperature. Each one of those curves, we're changing the voltage and measuring the resulting current, which is plateauing at some particular voltage. Okay, so we need to measure voltage and current lots of times. And in particular, we need to be able to change the voltage and measure the current, you know, kind of, you know, 50 points at once. So to do that, we have what are called source meters. And a source meter is a combination of two things we did in electronics. It basically can source voltages or currents, right? Remember, like the lambda did. VDA. And it wants to meter the voltages and currents, like the Keithley did. So this is one box that can do both of those things. But it doesn't do us a lot of good unless it can somehow write all those numbers down for us in our lab notebook. So this needs to somehow or other be connected to a computer. So the way this works is these source meters are connected to little boxes, and actually there are lots of meters that are connected to this box, that is called General Purpose Interface Bus Controller. And there are several of them. I think this particular one is called GPIB2. And GPIB2 goes to the internet. And of course, your computer sits on the internet. So you can use the internet to talk to this particular instrument and tell it to collect the data, and then it can send that data back, and you can have the computer write it in a file that you can then analyze at your leisure. Okay, so we need to be able to control these source meters and actually a voltmeter also, in order to run this experiment. And if we're doing it right, you know, basically all we do is hit return and the computer collects all of these curves, and then we spend the other 95% of our time analyzing the data. Okay. Yeah, so that's just as the name of my computer is Beta, the name of that device is GPIB2. These things are called, are generically called ENETs. And GPIB stands for General Purpose Interface Bus, and it's actually the name of the wire that connects, it's a big fat wire if you look at it, that connects this source meter to the GPIB bus. So buses are usually collections of wires. So you're taking, some of you are taking digital. So this is a byte sequential bus. So it sends a whole byte of data on 8 wires, and there are like 12 control wires too, in order to send all of this information eventually to your computer. Okay. So how many of you took 222 last year? A handful. Fortran/C. So we need to have a computer language to actually control these guys. And my favorite computer language is Fortran, because I claim it's the simplest language to learn. So for those of you who didn't learn a computer language, I think you'll be able to learn this one pretty quickly. Questions? So I think the best bet at this time is to go downstairs and to take a look and practice writing some code that you'll use to control these instruments. But maybe if you have your books ready, let me point out that the exact sequence of instructions that you want to use are already listed there. Right, so the sorts of things you need to do, and this is kind of the first thing you're actually going to do for this experiment, starting on page 120, actually 121, is to write code to do these various things. So let's go downstairs and log in and see how this is going to work. 121. Yep. So that's kind of the starting point is to